of the field are small, so in the first approximation, they do not interact. We have a free field COE with free particles with mass m, which are relativistic and which fly in space. And then we introduce a little bit of interaction, which means that when two particles meet, they collide and they are go again exactly like a game of ball. So in that way, we have seen that the functional integral formalism, in fact, allows to reproduce the rules, the Feynman graphical rules that you have already seen in the canonical quantization formalism. So we recover first the propagator for the free field, and second, we recover the rules how to compute products expectation value in the vacuum of products of operators. So the basic building block to construct, for instance, scattering amplitudes and to compute physical process in this quantum field theory. Okay. So let me remind just that I started from the action for a free field, which was, of course, in the Euclidean action dx 1/2 of d mu phi squared plus m squared over 2 phi squared g over factorial 4 phi 4. This is the action in the Euclidean formalism. And we know how to, what this corresponds to in Minkowski space. And we have seen that the famous Feynman rules to compute the physical process is that you have a propagator, which we represent by a line. And this propagator is its Fourier transform, it's 1 over p squared plus m squared. And we have a vertex of interaction, which represents the 5-4 term. And to this, each time we have this vertex, we have a factor minus g, because it's proportional to the interaction. So these are the Feynman rules in the Euclidean regime and in Minkowski space-time. In fact, we have seen for the propagator, but that this becomes the Feynman propagator. So with my notation, the propagator is minus pi over p squared plus m squared minus I epsilon plus. This is the standard notation you have seen in Kostias Arembo's course, how to control the singularities at p squared equal minus m squared. And the propagator in Minkowski space is just, you have to be just a bit careful, it's minus IG. Minus ig simply because in the functional integral, you have an exponential of I times the action, and in the action, the potential energy term, including this term, has a minus sign. Okay, so these are the Feynman rules in Euclidean space, and these are the Feynman rules in Minkowski space. Okay, and remember that in Minkowski space, I have the choice of signature minus, plus, plus, plus. So if P, the four momentum, is in this notation, it's omega and k, then P squared is minus omega squared plus k squared. So these are my notation. Okay, so we have seen that, I've showed you yesterday how you construct the perturbative expansion, and we have seen that how the Feynman diagrams appear and how correlation function in the field, so vacuum expectation value of time-ordered products of field operators, are expanded in terms of quantities which can be associated to Feynman diagrams. So today, I will discuss a little bit more, well, in fact, in depth, what is the structure of this perturbative expansion. And in particular, I will introduce a very important object, which is called the effective action, which looks a bit formal, but it will be very, very useful when discussing renormalization next week. And so I will postpone to next week the discussion of what are called the Feynman integrals, namely, what is the value of a diagram like that? This is a number, depending on the position of the point x and y, for instance. And I do not discuss at all what are the properties of this function. I will not discuss, in particular, the structure of the fact that there are ultraviolet singularities, so there are divergences. And if you have been a little bit if you thought a little bit about what I explained yesterday, you realize immediately that, for instance, the number associated to such a diagram here, which is called, by the way, a tadpole diagram in the literature, this is simply the expectation value in the vacuum of phi of x squared in the free theory. And we know that this object is infinite. It's infinite because simply, for instance, it is given in Euclidean space by the integral over the momenta k. So this is a ddk over 4 pi to the power d of 1 over k squared plus m squared. And of course, this integral is badly divergent when k goes to infinity. Yes?
So can you remind us why we get a minus sign in front of the g for the expansion in Euclidean
space? Okay, that's because here.
No, the other one.
Pardon? Oh, that's because in the action, the functional integral is exponential. In the functional integral, you have a d phi exponential of minus se of phi. So there is, somewhere here, there is an exponential of minus g integral dt is phi 4. So this is a minus sign here. And to answer the same question here, so this is in Euclidean, in Minkowski. What you have a d phi, you have an exponential of I se of phi. I'm sorry, this is the s of phi. So Minkowski is something which contains d dx, and you have a dt of phi squared minus 1/2 of dx of phi squared minus m squared over 2 phi squared minus g over 4 phi 4, because this whole term, all this term gets a minus sign. So you still have an I times minus g. Okay. Yes?
So why in the Minkowski space-time there is minus I epsilon, but in the Euclidean there isn't?
That's because it's just to implement the rules that when you integrate over omega in this integral, when you integrate, you can compute the Fourier transform of this propagator. And when you integrate over omega, you have the poles here at omega equal plus square root of k squared plus m squared and minus square root of k squared plus m squared. And this minus I epsilon, you can check that it amounts to integrate over a path in integration like that in omega. So you get the correct treatment of the singularities, which give you the good causal properties for the propagator. I think you have seen that in the CFT1 course. At least I checked that it's explained in the lecture notes. So I'm pretty sure Kostya explained to you that in detail. Okay?
So what about in the Euclidean? So this is in
the Pardon?
So this one is in the Minkowski?
Yes. That's because in the Euclidean, in fact, I explained last time, so this is in Minkowski. And in Euclidean, the path of integration has to be done in that way, in the Euclidean regime. So in the Euclidean regime, in fact, you don't care about where the singularity are. So this epsilon is just means that you have to integrate at a distance epsilon and take epsilon. Of course, epsilon goes to zero. This means that you compute this for epsilon positive. So it means that you take an epsilon plus, which is positive, and you compute this in the limit epsilon plus goes to zero. So you need to specify what you are doing in Euclidean, because if you are not careful, you could integrate like that, and you will get a different propagator. But in the Euclidean regime, you don't care, so you don't need to put an epsilon. You can put epsilon to zero from the beginning, and you don't. It just means that. This epsilon means simply the specification for the specification for the omega integration in the Fourier transform. Okay, good. Okay. Well, here I have forgotten about, you notice also that I put h bar equal 1. I will come back to that later because everywhere you have some h bar. Okay, so now let us come back to the structure of perturbed expansion, and I want to show you something. So then, will it work? I show you again. Yeah, it's recognized here, so it should come soon. Oh, I have to wait. Calm down. Yes. Okay. So here are what is called the vacuum diagram, which are present when you compute the partition function. So for the moment, don't pay attention to this one. This is the first diagram in the perturbed expansion. In the second diagram, now these are the diagrams which appears when you compute the two-point function. So the two-point function, you have the propagators, and this diagram, this diagram, this diagram, this diagram, and you see that in this expansion, some of the diagrams have a peculiar property. Those diagrams seem quite compact, but when you look at the two-point function, you see that these diagrams are composed of propagators. So there is a chain of propagators, and you have some building blocks, which are here circled by this blue, which have a special property. And this special property is the property of one line irreducibility. It means that if you take this diagram and you cut, you remove this line, it's not connected anymore. But if you remove this line, it's connected. Again, if you remove this line, it's connected. If you remove this line, it's connected. Here again, if you remove any of the line, it's still connected because you have two lines. So a diagram is one line irreducibility so take a graph, any graph. A graph is a set of lines connected by a set of points connected by lines. See? And a graph is irreducible. He said one line irreducible if it is connected and if it is still connected if you remove any of its line is removed. You see? So it's a topological definition. Okay. So you see, for instance, that in this diagram, this part is irreducible, this part is irreducible, this part is irreducible, but not this one. And if we continue, for the four-point function, here are the diagrams of this four-point function. Here are the diagrams which are connected in the four-point function, and I will... okay, let me show this. Okay. Here are the diagrams which appear, which are connected in the four-point function, and you see that here are the irreducible part. And in some sense, by definition, a single vertex is irreducible because a single vertex is connected. You have a point. And if you remove a line, you ask the question, what happens if I have a vertex and if I remove any of its line, is it still connected? And for a mathematician, if the set of lines is empty, then I say that it has a property. So since I cannot remove any line, it's connected if I remove a line. So, and if you go to the six-point function, again, you see the same structure. The irreducible part can be vertices, can be these tadpole diagrams. There can be this irreducible part which appeared already in the four-point function, and it may be this triangle diagram. You see? So the basic idea is that, in fact, in any case, you expect that Feynman diagrams will be built out of trees made out of connected diagrams. So in general, a diagram, a connected diagram, will be built out of a tree made out of propagators and let us call it here, irreducible parts. And therefore, the basic building block of the theory are those irreducible parts. And it's quite easy, if you know how to compute the irreducible parts, to compute all the perturbative expansion. Because to compute, for instance, in momentum space, the contribution of a diagram, which is a tree, it's very easy. Because it's just you have some momenta which flows and which is conserved along the tree, etc. So the difficult and the part which contains some physics, some non-trivial physics, are the irreducible part. So the question is how to compute those irreducible parts. Okay. And here comes the the beauty of the functional integral formalism, because it's Dan, can you raise it? Because I cannot do that. No, can you? It's you have to use this. There is. Oh, you still have the picture here. If you want to have a look, realize it's still up here. Okay. So how do we compute this this quantity? How do we compute the sum, so what we need to compute is the sum of all irreducible diagrams. Because from that, we can compute everything. And, oh, yes, I think it should. Yes. And in fact, the tool to construct this is to use generating functionals. Okay. And I think you have already encountered generating functional in the lecture about Gaussian integrals. And what I will be doing is just a generalization of that. And we have two tools. We have the tool of generating functional and the tool of Legendre. Transform. So first, generating functional. Remember that we consider that in Euclidean space, at least, everything is contained in this big functional integral. So all the correlation function can be computed if you know how to compute this integral and insert phi, products of phi at different points. So a very convenient way to do that is just is just to add a term which I will write minus g times phi. And I explain immediately what is this. You see, in this functional integral, phi of x. If you want, it's a random variable. So because it's represent, you integrate over all the possible value of phi, and this is the probability distribution for these random variables. And we integrate over phi. And it's a random variable because it is associated to a quantum field. Okay. So now I add to this a classical field. Classical means that it is just a function, g of x, from Minkowski space to the real. Okay, so it's a classical function. Okay, and g of x means simply the product g times phi means is a shorthand notation for integral over space of g of x times phi of x. And now, so this integral, we have a term which depends on two functions, phi and g. I integrate over phi, so at the end, I get a function of the function g of x. So it depends on g at any points. So it's a functional. And if I know how to compute this, in fact, if I know this function, I can compute all the correlation functions. Because you can check easily, for instance, that if I want to compute the expectation value of phi of x1, phi of x2, all what I have to do is to take the derivative of z with respect to g at point x1 of z of g. You see, because if I take a derivative with respect to g at point x2 from this, I get a factor phi of x2 divided by h bar. If I take this functional derivative with respect to x1, I get a phi over at point x1. You see? So of course, I must have an h bar squared. Of course, at the end, I have to set g equal to 0 in order to get rid of this term. So this term is non-zero in order to get those terms, but at the end of the calculation, you get 0. And of course, I have to divide by z of g equals 0 in order to have the proper normalization. So you see that if you know this function, the functional derivatives which are denoted delta over delta g of x, gives a factor h bar phi of x. And so you can compute correlation functions or, if you prefer, vacuum expectation value of products of field operators using this function. So if you know how to compute this function, you know how to compute all the correlation functions of the theory. So this object, which looks a bit formal, in fact, contains in itself all the correlation functions of the theory. So if we know how to manipulate this object, we know how to compute many, many, many interesting quantities, physical quantities of the quantum theory. OK? Yes?
Should that be del over del j goes to 1 over h bar phi?
No, because when you take a derivative, there is a 1 over h bar. So if I am interested in phi, I have to multiply by h bar.
Yes.
Yes, I'm sorry. Here. Yes, of course. So let us write it. That. Yes. Thank you. See the idea? OK. So basically, the idea is that z of g contains all the information about all the correlation function. Now, I make a claim. I don't prove it at that stage, but it's not very complicated to understand that. Instead of considering z of g, I will consider another function, w of g, which is is it h bar? It's proportional to the logarithm of z of g, and I had an h bar. So in other words, I write that z of g is exponential of is it h bar or 1 over h bar? I have a doubt that I shouldn't have, because I'm supposed to know this by heart. Yes, it is this. So z of g is 1 over h bar w of g. So I just take the logarithm of this function. So it's another functional. And you may be interested into what are the functional derivative of w of g. And in fact, claim one, w of g gives you all the connected diagrams and amplitudes. So I don't prove that at the moment, but it's not a very complicated object. And now I will define, so this is definition one. I define a new generating functional, which is just the logarithm of the first functional. And so WG is called the generating functional null of the connected correlation functions. Connected means that I'm keeping only the contribution of the connected Feynman diagrams. Okay? And for instance, in the case of the 5-4 theory, if I am interested in the connected correlation function, it's just the same thing than phi of x1, phi of x2, because all the diagrams are connected. But if I am computing the products of 4 phi connected, it's just a contribution of diagrams where you have this, but you don't have those diagrams. You forbid those diagrams and the other ones. So you keep only the connected diagrams. See? Okay. So now this is not the end, because what I'm going to introduce now is the Legendre transform of W of G. And the Legendre transform is a mathematical transformation, but you shouldn't be too afraid of that. Mm-hmm. You shouldn't be afraid of the term Legendre transform. Oh, here it is. Because physics is full of Legendre transform, and I will give you first the definition. If you have a function f of x, I define its Legendre transform, f, let us say, star of p, as simply the maximum, the supremum value, or the maximum when you vary x of the function, px minus f of x. So this is a mathematical definition. And you see immediately that in order to find the extremum of this function, of course, is given by the saddle point equation, p minus df so dx of x equals 0. You see? That's almost obvious. Okay? And at that point, so let me call this p star. That's the point. I look for a solution of this equation. Okay? And now I express it as a function of p. So basically, at this point, the value of the function is p x star minus f of x star, where x star is the solution of this equation. So you choose a p, you look for the point where the derivative of f is equal to p, call this point x star, and then take the new function, p x star minus f of x star, and consider it, of course, as a function of p, because in this equation, x star is a function of p. You see? Okay, so that's the mathematical definition. So That's a math definition. Now, in physics, where do you encounter mathematical Legendre transform? Well, that's very easy. In thermodynamics, you know, for instance, that if you have a system, a closed system, like a gas in a volume. Imagine that you have a gas in a volume. It's a closed system, so it's characterized by this entropy. You know, so it has an internal energy, U. Okay, and it is characterized by its entropy, S. And it is characterized by the volume of the system. So you have a box. It has some volume here. It has an entropy. And you are interested, it's in internal energy. OK? So then you know that if you are interested now not in the properties of the system as a function of the entropy, but as a function of the temperature. You know that the temperature is defined by du over ds. This is the temperature. Okay? And you know that where you are interested in the properties of the system as a function of its temperature, the correct object to consider, if, for instance, you want to compute the amount of work you can extract from the system in a heat engine, as a function of the temperature, what you have to consider there is the free energy, and more precisely, the Helmholtz free energy. And this Helmholtz free energy is F, which is defined by U minus TS. So we have T equal DU over TS, and we have F equal U minus TS. This is very similar to this. It means simply that a quantity that I will call W, let us say, which is minus F, this is a function of now the temperature and the volume. And this is the Legendre transform of U, the internal energy, with respect to the entropy. So I have a function of the entropy and of the volume, U of T, and U of S and V. I compute its Legendre transform with respect to the entropy. I get minus the free energy. See? And the same, if you make are interested in to the properties of the system as a function of the pressure. The pressure is related to the derivative of the energy with respect to the volume. And the enthalpy of the system is the Legendre transform of the energy with respect to the volume. So the rule is that the free energy is the Legendre transform with respect to the entropy, and the enthalpy of the system, enthalpy is the Legendre transform with respect to the volume. Okay. So what I'm going to do is to compute the same object, but at a more abstract level. So I define what is the Legendre transform of W. And I call it the effective action. So where is my computation? Yes, here it is. Okay. So I have my function w of g. In my functional, w of g. Okay. I defined an object which I'll call the background field, which is a classical phi, which I call phi of x, which is the functional derivative of w of g with respect to the value of g at a given point x, of course. But g is not fixed to 0. Warning, g is not fixed to g equals 0. So I'm looking for the extremum of the function w of g as a function of g, but keeping g fixed. So this background field, of course, is implicitly is a functional of g. It's a function of x and a functional of g. Okay? So I should rather write it as phi of x and g. But this is a number, this is a position, and this is a g. Okay? And now I do the same game. I define what is the Lejeune transform of w of g with respect to g itself. So the definition is just a generalization of the Lejeune transform. And I call this a functional gamma of phi. So it will be a functional of the background field. And this is called the effective action. So it's a bit abstract, but how is it defined? Exactly by this formula. This is simply gamma of phi is just p, the analog of p, namely the derivative of w with respect to g of x, so it's phi of x. And g times g of x. And I take the Lejeune transform with respect to all the value of x, so I integrate this over dx. I subtract my functional w of g. And I consider this, since phi is a functional of g. Remember, phi is a functional of g. So phi is a function which depends in a functional way of the function g. And then I can just make a change of variables. So instead of considering that phi as a function is a function of g, I may consider that g is a function of phi. You see? It's an abstract change of variable. Okay? So the two definitions that you have to know is this definition. I define the background field as the derivative of w of g with respect to g. So it's a function of the point at which you apply the functional derivative. And the effective action is defined by the Lejeune transform of w with respect to g, namely, is defined by integral over x of phi of x times g of x minus w of g. And then I re-express everything in terms of phi instead of in terms of g. So I will denote this in a compact way, exactly the same way that I define g phi. I define this as g times phi minus w of g. This is a shorthand notation for this definition. So, you see? So this seems a very abstract. This seems a very abstract definition. But it's a very, very important and deep concept. And you will see indeed immediately why this is a deep concept, because I will now, so this is an abstract definition. I have not said what is W of G. Now let us go back to the case of a quantum field theory here, quantum field theory, where I explained to you W of G is defined by this, where Z is an action. So let me rewrite. I consider Z, where I define Z of G as integral over d phi of exponential of minus 1 over h bar s of phi. I omit the Euclidean subscript here, but it's implicit. Okay, and W of G is defined by h bar times the logarithm of z of g. Okay. So now I will show you that a very beautiful formula, which is I will compute the effective action. So remember, the effective action is a functional of a classical field, phi of x. At order 1 in h bar. So I will do a quantum calculation, but a very short quantum calculation. And I will show you that the effective action gamma of phi, if h bar is equal to 0, so if we have no quantum effects, if we are considering classical theory, it is just the classical action. Started from. But then there are, of course, quantum correction. And the first quantum correction, the correction which is over the h bar, takes a very simple form. The result is just that this is h bar times 1/2 times the logarithm of a determinant, and the determinant is a determinant of the second derivative of the action. And then you have term of order h bar squared. So what is this determinant? What is the second derivative of the action? We have an action, s of phi. This is the classical field. We can define an operator, which is the second derivative of the action, which is an operator whose kernel depends on 2 points. So we have S dagger. Oh, I should. Very bad. Sorry, this is a mid. Okay, so S second is an operator, which is called the Hessian operator. It is just the operator whose kernel is the second order functional derivative of the action with respect to functional derivative phi of x of phi of y. So it's an operator which is equal to the matrix of second order derivative of the action S of phi. Okay? Yes?
For the definition of the effective action, we're taking the supremum over all possible J fields?
Yes. Yes. Exactly. Like here, we are taking the supremum of all the X's. All X's. Here, I'm taking the supremum of all the G. Okay? And so, so this is, you see, you have an action, you compute its second order derivative, you get a function of x and y. So this is some function k of x and y. It defines an operator in the sense that it's an operator which acts on function, and which, if you have a function f of x, k acts and transforms this function into a function kf of x, which is defined simply by the integral over y of k of x and y f of y. You see? So, in our particular case where in the particular case of the phi 4 action, this second order derivative of the phi 4 action S is simply the operator minus an operator which is minus the Laplacian operator plus m squared, plus g over 2 times phi squared of x. So this is an operator. This is an operator in the sense that if I apply this operator of phi to some function f and evaluate this object at a point x, this is simply this operator applied to the function f, so this is minus the Laplacian of f of x plus m squared of x. And I apply this operator, which is just a function at the point x, to the function f of x, so this is simply g over 2 times the field phi squared of x, which multiplies the function f of x. So you see, this is this S dot is a linear operator acting on functions F in space. But this linear operator depends on the function phi. And if, since it's a linear operator, so it's a functional operator, you may compute, well, there are subtleties, but you may compute its determinant and take its log. And of course, you have a well-known formula, which is for any matrix, the logarithm of the determinant of an operator is just equal to the trace of the logarithm of this operator. Okay? So it's the usual way we write this very important formula that I will emphasize.
Thank you.
can rewrite this as S of phi plus h bar over 2, the trace of the logarithm of an operator, which is the second derivative of the action evaluated at the classical action. Okay. So it's a very simple formula, and we'll see what it means. So how much time do I have left? Well, perhaps in order to make things clear, I will not prove this formula. I will try to do it on Monday, but I will show you what it means, what this formal formula means for the 5-4 theory. So for the moment, believe this formula. And this formula, important fact is that it's a very general formula. When you prove this formula, it doesn't depend on the specific size of the action. So it's a generic. It's a general. For any action S of phi involving bosonic fields, there are some subtleties for fermionic fields. But for any action, for any field, you always have the same formula. You see?
So the formula comes from the
pardon?
That one comes from that one?
This formula comes from that definition when you compute it using the functional integral formalism. Yes, no, the point is that I just have 20 minutes, let's say. And this formula will take a bit longer. So, yes?
For the application of S double prime F on X, should the second term on the right-hand side be N squared FX?
Oh, yes, yes. I'm very, very sorry. Once again, I made a mistake. This is, of course, f of x. Yes, you are right. Okay. I apologize. Okay. So this is for the 5-4 theory. The value of this yes?
I tried to compare this, what is this transformation called?
Legendre, yes?
Yeah. Legendre transformation with what we see before when we transform the Lagrangian into the Hamiltonian. And so for Lagrangian, we have the argument of X. And for the Hamiltonian, we have the argument of X and T.
Yes.
So, would you mind repeating how the argument change if you do the L transformation?
I'm not sure I understand your question, but I think your remark is nice. There is also, in classical mechanics, the relation between the action, which is a function of the position of a particle and of the speed of the particle, and the Hamiltonian, which is a function of the position of the particle and of the momentum of the particle, is also a Legendre transformation. So the Legendre transformation maps Lagrangian dynamics into Hamiltonian dynamics. I don't know if that's what you mean.
So I was asking how the argument change if you do this transformation.
Ah, you are asking me to try to define an effective action with an Hamiltonian formulation of quantum mechanics.
So
no?
I was asking so like in Lagrangian we have argument of x and x dot.
Yes.
And so after we do the transformation, the Hamiltonian has the argument of x and p.
Yes.
So so what about this case? I suppose you have the argument of j and then you transform.
There is some relation, but it's not here. I am not doing this transformation is not a transformation from an action, so from a Lagrangian to an Hamiltonian. It's something different. I'm working on the action, not on the Lagrangian. And I'm doing it for a quantum theory. Yes?
His question is, I mean, on the right-hand side, you have something with respect to J and how you transform, you eliminate the dependence on J.
Yes.
That's why you do the Laurent transformation. You take the supremum and you put the partial factor J equal
yes.
to 0. It's exactly the Laurent transformation.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yes. Okay, so let me continue and then I can answer a question or there is some question and answer session. So let me compute what does it mean the trace of the logarithm of this operator when the operator is the Hessian of the action of the phi 4 theory. So it is this operator minus Laplacian plus m squared plus multiplication by phi square of x. So I want to compute, so you see the effective action is a classical action plus a quantum correction. So what is the quantum correction for this term? Okay, the quantum correction for this term is proportional to h bar, therefore, oh, let me write it, use those blackboards because I will need some. Okay, so I think I don't need that anymore. And so I am interested in computing what is h bar 1/2. The trace of the logarithm of an operator which is minus the Laplacian plus m squared plus g over 2 times phi squared of x. Okay? So what does it mean, the trace? The trace is, of course, as usual, if we have the logarithm of an operator, the trace is the integral over dx of space of the matrix element of x times. I will write that first. I do something simple. I can rewrite this operator minus Laplacian plus m squared plus g over 2 phi square of x. I do a trick. I write this as minus the Laplacian plus m squared times the identity operator plus 1 over minus Laplacian plus m squared times g over 2 phi square of x. Okay? I multiplied, then divide. Now, I have a general formula that, remember, what is the logarithm of an operator? You can write an operator as, for instance, a sum over projector of the states of its eigenvalues AI, if I diagonalize the operator. And if I diagonalize the operator, the logarithm of A is simply sum of the projector onto its eigenvalues of the logarithm of the eigenvalues. That's the definition of the logarithm of an operator. And you can show quite easily that the trace of a logarithm of the products of two operators, you can apply the rule of multiplication, that the logarithm of the products of two operators is the sum of the products of the sum of the logs. So you can write this as a trace of log of A plus the trace of log of b. So the rule of multiplication for the logarithm applies to operator when you take the trace. And therefore, I can write this object as h bar 1/2 trace of logarithm of minus Laplacian plus m squared. This is something which is relative to the free field, plus h bar 1/2 of trace of logarithm of the operator 1 plus 1 over minus Laplacian squared times g over 2 times phi squared. Let us, well, there is no x. It's an operator, so this is I'm sorry, this is an operator, so it's multiplication by phi squared. Yes. You see? Okay. So this is something I don't, which is independent of the fact that the theory is interacting or not. Okay? So the interesting term is this one. This term, then, I have a trace of the logarithm of 1 plus an operator, and here you have the coupling constant. So you can expand the logarithm in series, do a series expansion in G. I can rewrite this term as trace of sum from k equal 1 to infinity of minus 1 to the power k minus 1 divided by k times the operator, and then 1 over minus Laplacian plus m squared times I will have a g over 2 to the power, let us write it. I have a g over 2 to the power k. And then I have the operator minus Laplacian plus m squared times phi squared to the power k. You see, I'm doing manipulation. Remember, this represents an operator. This is an operator. This is an operator. And I'm taking the trace of the logarithm of this object, but then I can expand the logarithm. This is a series expansion of the logarithm. And then, of course, I can rewrite this as just a sum from k equal 1 to infinity of minus 1 to the power k minus 1 divided by k, g over 2 to the power k times the trace of this operator, minus Laplacian plus m squared times phi squared to the power k. So I'm having this operator to the power k, and I take the trace. Okay, so this is the expression for this quantity. There is a h bar over 1 over 1/2 in front. So now, the non-trivial object I want to compute is this object, the trace of these products of operator. And now I have to just to think a little bit of what it means in terms of functional calculus. What does it mean, my box here, my orange box, which is the trace of a product of 1 over minus Laplacian plus m squared times phi squared. And of course, if I explicit the product, I take times these products of operator. See? What does it mean? Remember, this and this are operators acting on functions of a space. That's what I wrote here. So, those operators have some kernel. So I can just insert the trace of an operator. If I have a trace of a big operator, this means simply integral over x of the matrix element OP of x. This is the definition of a trace, because all those operators act on function f of x. You see? So trace means exactly like in quantum mechanics, integral over all the position of the matrix element, diagonal matrix element of this operator. So there are operators like the Schrödinger operator acting on a function. You see? Now I can also insert, I have the relation that the identity operator is integral dd of x times x times x. So I can insert identities operator everywhere. And you start to recognize the kind of tricks we were using when one derives the path integral formalism. So at the end, of course, you may ask, what is the matrix element of the operator phi squared between two positions? This is simply phi squared of x times the delta function of x minus y. So this is a Dirac function, Dirac distribution. And this is the value of the function phi at the point x. We ask, what is the matrix element of the operator 1 over minus Laplacian plus m squared between two points x and y? Well, this is just the propagator. This is the Euclidean propagator. This is the Euclidean propagator. Of the free field theory. You see? So this object, in fact, I take the trace. So I integrate over first point x1, you see? And at the end of the trace, I have here the phi squared of x1. Okay. Then I insert an identity operator with a point x2 here. So what do I have is that I have the propagator G, E, Euclidean propagator of x1 minus x2. Then I have phi squared of x2. Then I have the propagator G, E of x2 minus x3, because here I assume I insert an x1. Here I insert an x2. Here I insert an x3, etc. And here I have inserted an x1, and you see that at the end, you have inserted k propagator, and of course, you integrate not only over the position of x1, but over xk. So this trace, the trace of this operator is just equal to a big integral over the position of k points in space of the products of propagators times the value of the background field phi squared at the point x2 So it's a propagator, value of the field, propagator, value of the field. Of course, here you have a phi squared of x3, etc. So this is just, you have propagators between x1 and x2, so you can reproduce it. Here I have my point x1. I have a propagator between x1 and x2. Then I have here a phi squared of x2. So here, phi squared of x2. Then I have a propagator between x2 and x3. Then I have a phi squared of x3. Then I have a propagator between x3 and x4. I have a phi squared of x4, etc., up to the point xk where I have a phi squared of xk, you see. So this is the value of this object. So this is a representation in terms of Feynman diagrams, because since I have propagators, I can write a Feynman diagram. So this is a Feynman diagram of this trace, of this object. See? And now I regroup everything. Okay, fixed. I think I don't need this anymore, but I still need that, so I will use a manual. So finally, what do I get for the term of order h bar of the effective action? Gamma of I is the classical action plus a term of order h bar. The term of order h bar is a sum of trace of term which can be represented by Feynman diagram. So what is this? The first term is, so remember, I have a factor 1 half. The first term is k equal 1. K equal 1 is these diagrams. Because here you have just phi squared 1. So I get 1 half of these diagrams where here I have a phi squared of x1. So I have attached phi squared here. The second term, k equal 2, is represented by a diagram where you have x1 and x2, and then it closes. So you have a diagram like that, where here you have x1, you have x2. Well, here you just add x1, and you integrate over x1, x2. And you work out what are the factors. You have a factor 1 half. You have a factor minus 1. Of course, there is a factor g. Well, you have a factor g over 2, so you had a factor g over 4. So I forgot the factor g over 2. So you have a factor 1 half in front of the h bar 1 half, and you have a factor g over 2. So you get a factor g over 4. Now, at second order, it's a term of order k equal 2. You have a factor 1 half. You have a factor 1 over k, which is 1 half. You have a factor g over 2. So you get a factor g over 16. And then you have this diagram. The contribution of this diagram, you have 2 points at x1 and x2. And you have 2 propagators joining x1 and x2. And at each point, you multiply by the value of x squared at this point. You see? Now, go to k equals 3. K equals 3, now you start to be used to that. You have a triangle diagrams between the point x1, x2, x3. Therefore, yes?
Should that be g squared over 16?
This is g squared, of course. Thank you very much. Then you start to see the logic. Here you have a plus. You have a g4. Then you have a factor 1/2. You have a factor 3. You have a 2 to the power 3. This is a g3. And you get these diagrams with a 5-4 here, a 5-4 here, a 5-4 here. And then I continue. You get a minus g to the power 4, 2 times divided by 2 times 4 times 2 to the power 4 times these diagrams, etc. So you see that indeed this object contains the sum over all irreducible one loop diagrams of the 5-4 quantum field theory. Yes?
Is there another closed loop without the pi squares?
You could say that, and you are right, because remember, yes, because I forgot to add to those this first term,
the trace log minus delta,
which was there, so which is of course of order h bar 2, so also of order h bar. So if I write this term, let me write this term. It's just, if you want a definition, minus h bar 1/2 times a circular loop. So it's just a definition of this term. This is a number. It's a big number. These are infinities, but we don't care. I write, this is a diagrammatic representation. Representation of this trace of a log of a determinant. And if I added to these terms, I get a minus 1/2, this pure number which doesn't depend on phi. And here I am happy because I think I am done. You see? So thank you for your remark, because I forgot the term I disregarded at the beginning, because it's a contribution of the free theory. You see? So at one loop, at h bar, at order h bar, we get all the diagrams which are irreducible, and of course all the diagrams which contains only one loop, because I'm expanding this trace of a logarithm. So the fact that I have a trace means that I have a one loop. And I will finish this lecture by stating that this is not a miracle. If you were able to do the calculation at order h bar squared, what you would get is a sum of two loops irreducible diagrams. So you would get contribution involving, for instance, diagrams like that. Diagram like that. And I think that's it. Can I have? No, I think that's it. That kind of diagrams. Okay? And at order h bar 3, you would have irreducible diagrams with three loops like that, etc. Of course, this is a much, much more complicated calculation. Well, it can be done. It's not very, very complicated, but you have to be careful. And in fact, there is a general feature, which is in fact the perturbative expansion. Expansion in any quantum field theory, not only the Phi-4 theory, we'll see example of that later on for the Dirac field and for gauge field, is an expansion in powers of h bar. So if you regroup the diagrams as a power of h bar, you see that the power h bar is a number of loops of the Feynman diagrammatic representation. I'm not sure you see it here, but so in fact, if you are interested in computing the quantum correction to order h bar k to a process in a quantum field theory, you have to compute to evaluate the contribution of the Feynman diagrams, which have k loops. And that's very general. It's true not only for Phi-4, but it's true for any quantum field theory. So there's a relation between the topology of the perturbative expansion and the order in which you are probing the quantum theory and probing the quantum effects of your theory. And it's a very deep and general relation. And for that reason, the perturbative expansion is very often called the loop expansion. And if you look at papers or discussion in high energy physics discussing processes of complicated calculation of evaluating processes occurring in the LHC, for instance, people say we have evaluated process at one loop, at two loops, at three loops, etc. That's what it means. And one final remark, well, I'm very late. Of course, the contribution of the classical action is a contribution of diagrams with no loops, namely tree diagrams. So the contribution you obtain just by making a computation using the classical action is often called, I study a quantum theory at tree level. Tree level because I'm considering process, like, I don't know, for instance, a process in quantum electrodynamics, like having you have an electron, an anti-electron, E plus, E minus, interacting and creating another electron with a gamma interaction. This is a tree process. So, of course, it's a quantum process. But the diagrams which is associated to this process is a tree diagram, so which means that you can study just by solving some classical equation of motion of the theory. While, of course, this diagram is a one-loop process, etc. Yes?
Yeah, this three-loop diagram is not good because
so, which diagram?
Because you have other cube, not the other one.
Yes?
Yeah, you have one 4 points and two 3 points. You should put the cat eye in that one.
Pardon?
The cat eye.
This one?
No, this, no.
This one?
No, no, the last one.
No, yeah.
It is not 5-4 that.
No, no, it is a 5-4 theory because you may very well have a phi attached here, a phi attached here. Here you have no phi, and you can. It's a very schematic description. So here you can have a phi squared. Here you can have phi squared, phi squared. You see, if you have a three vertex, you still have room for attaching one phi. You see. So it's a, it was just a graphical picture. You see, it corresponds to a, you know, for instance, well, I think a process like that, where you have phi and the phi. Remember, I show a diagram like that in the perturbative expansion, and I explain this is the reducible part of these diagrams. This is associated to a diagram like that. So already at two loop in 5-4 in the two-point function, you have this diagram. But, well, I wanted to discuss that in detail so that you understand the mechanics. And for the moment, forget about that. In the remaining of the course, we'll always do calculation only at one loop. There is already a lot of work to do to understand what it means. Yes?
Out of curiosity, the loop with no vertices, does that correspond to a vacuum?
Yes, this is called a vacuum. This is a contribution of this is the contribution to the vacuum energy density of quantum fluctuations. Because it's a term which is already there in the free theory. So it's a contribution which gives you the energy of the vacuum in the free theory, the sum of the rest energy of all the modes of the field. Okay. Now, sorry for being too long, but I hope you got the picture. So you see that it sounds very technical and at the beginning, but at the end, you get this beautiful graphical interpretation and rules of calculation. Yes?
In the each bottom, you can use the Gaussian integral.
I'm sorry?
In the each bottom.
Yes?
You can use the Gaussian integral, and then you get a determinant.
Yes.
But in the next order, how do you compute integral?
You have to be more careful. You have to compute the correction to the determinant. And that's how you get those diagrams. You compute what are the correction to the Gaussian approximation of a functional integral. But as usual, you know, you expand in power of h bar and you use Vic theorem. Oops, sorry. You use the results of Gaussian integration, but at next order. So it's always at some point amounts some application of the Vic theorem, but a more sophisticated application.